gravitational waves as approximate solutions to Einstein's field equations for the case that you're sufficiently far away kind of from the source to consider them as weak, it turns out to be convenient to split the full metric G mu nu into a background piece, usually the Minkowski metric, eta mu nu, plus a perturbation, which I called F mu nu. And what we did, we kept only terms linear in this F mu nu. And then given an appropriate choice of gauge, the Saussure Einstein equations reduced to the simple wave equation, so box F equal to zero, which is very nice because then we can immediately write down a bunch of solutions in terms of plane waves. I only briefly mentioned kind of what the physical effect of these waves is, and that is best illustrated by looking at a kind of circular array of test masses that sit in a plane perpendicular to the wave vector. And this circle will be deformed kind of periodically. And there are basically two linearly independent polarizations such a wave can have. So they're kind of to 2 degrees of freedom of the theory. And kind of just in terms of, you can parameterize. So it's a two-dimensional linear vector space. A two-dimensional linear space. So just as you have, if you're in four dimensions, kind of the vectors form a four-dimensional space. If you look at two tensors, or what we are interested in, symmetric two tensors, they also form a linear space of dimension 10, because you know it just you can write them as symmetric 4x4 matrices. So that's easy to see that you have 10 independent entries. And what I was saying, so the polarizations, the possible polarizations for such a wave, they live in a two-dimensional subspace. And of course, you are free how to choose a basis in that subspace. And you can use a basis that is refers to what is called a linear polarization, or another one I introduced by just taking linear combinations of basis vectors was a circular polarization. So you could have left and right unit polarization tensors. But of course, this is just a choice of basis. What was nice about these circularly polarized waves is that they have a specific behavior under rotations about the axis of propagation. So simple rotations by some angle phi. And what we found then, looking at what happens to a circularly polarized wave, it picked up a phase factor e to the 2i plus or minus 2i phi under such a rotation. And that is characteristic for the gravitational waves, and it characterizes what one calls their helicity. So that is just a physical, you know, what characterizes them physically. Now, what we talk about today, and the reason for why this classical discussion of weak gravitational waves is important, is that there is a standard construction as a for a now a perturbative quantum field theory that builds, if you like, on this space of classical plane wave solutions of linearized gravity. And that is kind of the standard, so it says a Fock space construction. And I assume, of course, you've met this in one form or other, but I'll give you just a lightning review of that. Again, I mean, what is the logic behind this setup, and how what specific features does it have in the case of gravity? So that's really kind of a lightning review of what such a Fock space construction or Fock space representation is all about. So, of course, where one usually starts motivating this is in the very simple case, I mean, in mechanics, just look at the, looking at the one-dimensional harmonic oscillator, for simplicity, let us choose it to have unit mass m. And I have just two canonically conjugate variables, the position x and the momentum p, and they appear quadratically in the Hamiltonian like this. H is p squared divided by 2 plus omega squared x squared divided by 2, where omega is just a constant. And these x and p can be thought of as coordinates on a two-dimensional phase space, R2, and they obey a Poisson bracket, canonical Poisson brackets. X with P gives 1. That's something actually we'll come back to later in the lecture when we talk about a canonical quantization. So this is an example just of a classical Poisson bracket, or as one also says, a symplectic structure. So this is, these are phase-space coordinates. And in the quantum theory, these are turned, these relations kind of persist, and they become the canonical commutation relations of the self-adjoint operators x hat and p hat of the quantum theory of this one-dimensional oscillator. And this picks up in the usual way, kind of an I h bar on the right hand side. Of course, in the familiar, also familiar way, one easy way kind of of solving the quantum theory, that is just finding the spectrum of h hat, is to go kind of over to complex linear combinations of the x hat and p hat. And this should all be kind of familiar to you. So complex linear combinations, a hat, so with some numerical coefficients, square root omega half x hat plus I divided by square root of 2 omega p hat. And similarly, for its adjoint, a hat dagger, you get the same thing with a minus sign. And these then obey another set of commutation relations, namely that A with A dagger commutes to an H bar without the factor of I. Now, please recall that, I mean, the A and the A hats, they're not self-adjoint, so they're not directly related to observables in this quantum mechanical example. I have a very simple expression in terms of these operators for the Hamiltonian, though. It's given by h bar omega a dagger hat a plus 1/2. And I can, in a straightforward way, diagonalize this and exhibit a set of eigenstates labeled by capital N, and the spectrum of H is given by all values N plus 1/2 in units of H bar omega, where N is just the zero or a positive integer. So that just solves the quantum theory of this super simple example. Now, one thing you should note is that the spectrum is special in the sense that it's equidistant. Right? So it just comes in discrete bits of h bar omega. I jump from one to the next. Now I should still, before I continue this train of thought, I should still write down kind of what the ground state is. This is a Hamiltonian that's bounded, has a spectrum that's bounded below. Obviously, by what I've written down, the ground state is just zero, and it's characterized by the fact that applying operator A on it gives zero, and evaluating H on the ground state actually doesn't give zero, but a non-vanishing ground state energy of H bar omega half, also called zero point energy. So, I mean, so far, so familiar. Now, the fact that this is an equidistant spectrum allows me, if I want, to interpret a state N as kind of describing N bits or N particles, which then all contribute in a fixed unit to the energy. Of course, if the spectrum wasn't equidistant, I couldn't do it that way. But so here, this suggests that I can think of N perhaps as a state of N particles, indistinguishable particles, each contributing an energy H bar omega. Now, this is mechanics, but this immediately generalizes this construction to, say, a free boson field, so to field theory, quantum field theory, where classically what one wants to, the equation one wants to solve, say, for a massive scalar field, is the Klein-Gordon equation. What is a Klein-Gordon equation? It's just box minus m squared applied on the scalar field phi of x. Just writing it out for you, it's minus dt squared plus nabla squared minus m squared on phi is zero. And of course, again, you know, like the wave equation, this can be solved in a straightforward manner by going to Fourier space. Right. So writing an ansatz where phi of x is just an infinite integral over zero modes, over a momentum mode k, and one then finds kind of that each of these modes separately corresponds in a way to a harmonic oscillator system of that specific energy. But the modes all decouple because of the free theory. So solving that kind of free quantum field theory is as easy as solving the one-dimensional quantum harmonic oscillator. Yeah. So what you get is harmonic oscillators with where now this omega is determined by the momentum, or the three momentum vector in this case, which is given by the square root of m squared plus k squared. So, but really what you're doing is, yeah, you can, after Fourier transformation, you see that it, all these equations decouple for all the different values of k. So immediately, you can write down a complete solution classically, but also kind of quantize it according to this scheme. And what you then get are so-called creation and annihilation operators, so in complete analogy with the one-dimensional case here, I call them also a hat dagger and a hat, but now they have an additional dependence on this momentum, so I get a copy of this system for each three momentum k. So that's what this is, a hat of k. And of course, they obey analogous commutation relations. We have written them down, to the ones down here. Namely, so now, of course, I have this k label floating around. So what I have to specify is actually what happens for an arbitrary pair of labels, k and k prime. And of course, since this is a continuous label, what I pick up in addition to the h bar, which anyway, this quantum field theoretic context in natural units is usually set to 1, what I pick up is just a three-dimensional delta function, Dirac delta function, k minus k prime. So these are my commutation relations, and I set secretly h bar to 1 here, as is usual convention in quantum field theory. Now, I have now a ground state with respect to all of these modes, different k modes, and in this field theoretic context, I call this a vacuum state. And what I get by now applying, say, a creation operator corresponding to the wave vector k is what is called a one particle state. And you can simply then label it by the corresponding three momentum. So this lies in the Hilbert space, curly H, and that's the Hilbert space of one particle states. So each of these modes I now interpret as a particle. So the vacuum is again defined by, or you can define it by operating, say it's annihilated. This is also called kind of an annihilation condition because it destroys this ground state by applying, so all the A hats with all different arguments k on it. It will always vanish. That's one way of defining it if you want to do this, kind of set this up more algebraically. Now, of course, usually you are interested not in single particle states, but in multi-particle states. I mean, that's, of course, what quantum field theory is about. I mean, you can create and annihilate states, modes. And so, for example, you could create a two-particle state just by operating with this creation operator twice on the ground state. So I have, say, one a hat dagger of k primed, another a hat dagger of k, and then I would just denote the resulting state by two momentum vector labels, k prime and k. So this then lies in the Hilbert space of two particle states, and I get that simply by taking the tensor product of this one particle Hilbert space with itself. So this state clearly lies in there. You can call this H tensor 2, which makes your life somewhat easier when you then start talking about n particle states. Then, of course, they will lie in the n-fold tensor product of the Hilbert space. So this, in a way, this is just kind of formalism to fix your kinematical setting here. So this was a two-particle and the entire space of states I'm interested in contains particle states or with arbitrary numbers of particle. So that's therefore kind of the relevant, the interesting space, you know, where I would consider dynamics. I call this curly F. It consists of a direct sum where n runs from 0 to infinity of these n-fold tensor products of this original one-particle Hilbert space. And that is the famous Fock space. Named after Russian physicist Fock. And what you usually still do, for example, this is now a scalar field theory. The relevant states lie in the symmetric kind of subspace. So you symmetrize all the n particle states with respect to interchanging entries just in accordance with the kind of statistical, the nature, the bosonic nature of these individual particles. Of course, if you had fermions, then you would look at the anti-symmetric sector, so where you anti-symmetrize over each pair, kind of, if you like, of entries here, of labels that appear in an n-particle state. So this is now kind of the kinematical habitat on which happens perturbative quantum field theory, this Fock space here, on Minkowski space. So, of course, that's what we've been implicitly using here. Now, the nice thing is that every interesting quantum field theoretic operator can be written as some linear combination of expressions you can write in terms of the A's and the A daggers. Okay, so then the fun can kind of begin. And for gravity, it works just in the same way. So this is here kind of what I've sketched here. That would be kind of the bosonic, the ingredient, the Fock space for the bosonic theory. The only other thing I have to keep track of for the gravitational case is I have this additional degree of freedom that classically was this polarization. So I have to, that has to come in here in some way. But the basic setup will be identical. You'll have annihilation and creation operators, but not just for particles of momentum k, but particles of momentum k with a specific polarization on top of it. But this is really a kind of trivial generalization. Before I get to this, before I get to this, let me elaborate a little bit of about well what becomes of this helicity in the quantum field theory, and how does it have to do really in a very intimate way with kind of the Minkowskian background of things. So, of course, you know, when you learn about quantum field theory, you would usually not consider anything but field theories on a flat background, four-dimensional Minkowskian background. And, well, although it might sometimes be not emphasized, that is a prerequisite for setting up kind of the entire machinery of relativistic quantum field theories. Because what does a relativistic refer to? It refers to the fact that the theory is invariant, or depending on the quantities you're looking at, covariant under Poincaré transformation. So that is, you know, Lorentz transformations plus linear transformations. So that's really what kind of the essence and one of the key ingredients in the construction. So relativistic quantum field theory on Minkowski space, of course, that's kind of implicit when one says this, it has Poincaré symmetry. So what is Poincaré symmetry? You can, again, purely think of it at the level of the action, say. So for these, all of these relativistic quantum field theories, that action would just be invariant under Poincaré transformations. So these are global symmetries. Of kind of flat Minkowski space-time. And of course, I can always choose some inertial frame where I then have global coordinate X mu on this four-dimensional space. And they transform, well, just according to a Poincaré transformation. So coordinates x mu get mapped onto other coordinates y mu, which are related to the old ones by 4 by 4 matrix lambda mu nu, scalar product with x nu, plus a mu. So what is happening here? So we have this set of global coordinates, so that parameterize, you know, each point in Minkowski space uniquely. And now I can do two things. I can Lorentz boost them. So that's what this kind of rotational piece refers to. So, of course, that's a linear transformation. And what it contains are, of course, the true rotations in the spatial directions plus the three boosts that are kind of rotations in the time direction and one of the spatial directions. So these are the Lorentz transform, what's called the Lorentz transformations. So yeah, just to remind you what this is about, this consists of three independent rotations and three independent Lorentz boosts. And this piece are just translations, constant translations in the four space-time directions. So this alone are the Lorentz transformations. If I add these four translations, I have the full Poincaré transformations. And a somewhat more abstract mathematical way of thinking about this is that, well, they actually form, these transformations form a group. Not just that, they form a Lie group. A Lie group always depends on a bunch of parameters that I can continuously vary. In this case, there would be 10 parameters, because kind of six independent parameters that characterize kind of the size of the Lorentz transformation, and another 4 that specify the magnitude of the spatial translation. So there are 10 independent parameters. So what we have here is an example of a 10-dimensional Lie group of symmetries. Global symmetries means they do not themselves depend on where I am in space-time. So any x undergoes this transformation in the same way. So it's different kind of from the local gauge transformation, like the diffeomorphisms we talked about for gravity, say, or the U1 transformations in electromagnetism. They are local, so they depend, their strengths can depend on where I am. But this here, these are global symmetries, so what they do is they take all of Minkowski space and whoops, you know, shift it along or boost it in some way, you know, all of it simultaneously. So it's of course also a finite dimensional group, whereas the diffeomorphism group is actually an infinite dimensional group because I can, you know, do this locally, independently. Okay, so this is a 10-dimensional non-compact, as a matter of fact, Lie group. And of course, you can characterize it as a group that leaves Lorentzian, Minkowskian, four-dimensional scalar products invariant. And it's characterized by writing down the Lie algebra of the infinitesimal generators of that group. And I hope you also know about Lie groups that essentially, you know, almost all of the structure in of that group is already apparent when I just sit at the kind of identity of the group. So where all my group parameters do nothing, so that's kind of the unit element, and I just consider infinitesimal transformations away from that. And these infinitesimal transformations are kind of directions in group space. I can label them by kind of the, what is called the generators of these of the group. And the generators, one way of writing down the generators is as capital P, so these are the infinitesimal generators of the translations, the four translations, and they satisfy a commutator algebra of the following kind. So a P with a P commutes. So you can just think of them as, well, vector fields, if you like. That, they're just linear operators. And this just says, well, the translation part forms an abelian subgroup. So I can, I mean, they don't affect each other. However, if I now consider, in addition, the generators of this Lorentzian part, this is no longer true. Then you get non-vanishing right-hand sides. So I'm just writing these down kind of for reference. And to remind you, I hope you've seen this somewhere, the generators of the Lorentz group, they have now two indices kind of to accord with this structure. And that is a non-vanishing right-hand side. Where now the Minkowski metric appears, eta mu nu p lambda minus eta mu lambda p nu. And then there's a third relation, where you have to know what the commutator of a J mu nu is with another J, rho sigma, say. And then you get kind of a complicated expression on the right-hand side, which is, again, linear, of course, eta mu rho G mu sigma plus eta sigma mu J rho mu minus eta nu rho j mu sigma minus eta sigma nu J rho mu. They're all linear, because that's what the Lie algebra is about. So these are linear relations with constant coefficients. And they capture just the structure of the Lie algebra, and up to global properties, they even capture all properties of the corresponding group. So that was this 10-dimensional Poincaré group. And in the quantum theory, these symmetries, as usual, will be implemented by unitary transformations. So unitary transformations, of course, they don't change kind of probabilities. So that is how you implement such a symmetry at the quantum level. Through the action of unitary matrices. That, of course, holds for the not for the infinitesimal transformations, but well, for the full transformation, unitary action on the quantum states. So quantum states psi will be mapped into some unitary matrix, which, of course, must know about the lambda and the A, right here, the 10 parameters applied on some wave function psi. Now, why is this relevant in our context? Well, you can think of particles, you know, like the one I had just gave to you kind of in as elements of this Fock space. You can classify particles according to how they behave under the action of the Poincaré group. And, well, according to their mass and spin. Now, these statements are intimately related to, well, the action of this Poincaré group, and you can even turn things around, and you can define particles as corresponding to different irreducible representations of the Poincaré group. So sometimes people, you know, talk in a kind of offhand manner about, oh yeah, a particle, oh, that's just a unitary irrep of the Poincaré group. Now, what is meant by this statement is that you can now, you're interested for the purposes of the quantum theory, I mean, any interesting physics will happen in a representation of the Poincaré group, because that's kind of, it's at the heart, I mean, this invariance is really at the heart of constructing these quantum field theories. And the types of fields that appear can be characterized by how they transform in different ways under the unitary action of that group. And transforming in different ways just means they are different things. So they are, for instance, they are, you know, particles, massless, massive, that have a certain mass and a certain spin. And that mass and spin can be thought of as characterizing a given representation of that group. So if you're mystified by these statements, well, just bear with me. What this means for our case, I'll say in a second. So we classify particles according to their transformation behavior. Under these unitary transformations, and you can, the unitary representations, they have kind of elementary ones that are these irreducible representations to which you can reduce everything. They're kind of the elementary building blocks behavior under unitary irreducible representations of the Poincaré group. And these different representations, they are just labeled by a couple of numbers, essentially their mass and their spin. And the way this plays out at the level of the algebra is you can define certain operators which are quadratic in these P's and J's that are so-called Casimir operators. And the Casimir operators have the particular property that they commute with all the generators. So that means the eigenvalues of these Casimir operators really characterize in a unique way kind of irreducible representations. Let me not dwell further on this. Now, if I come to kind of the gravity case, which is what interests us, so let me erase this here on the left-hand side first. So now returning to the case of gravity, linearized gravity more specifically, we have one particle states. And as I said before, well, they clearly they'll have a momentum label, just like kind of the bosonic fields, but they in addition have a helicity label, the sigma, which we've already met in the classical theory. So now what happens? So these states are eigenstates of the four the generators of the in the four the translation generators of the Poincaré group. So operating with a p mu on those just gives the value of the four vector times the state back. So that's kind of an eigenvalue equation. And of course, because the p's mutually commute, you know, I can diagonalize them independently, separately, at the level of a unitary transformation. Then I have to exponentiate these. So these are self-adjoint to e to the I. P is a unitary operator. So let me choose for this unitary operator. I have the lambda piece. I've set the lambda piece to unity. So I'm not doing any rotations or boosts. I'm just translating it. So that applied on the state gives me an e to the minus I a mu p mu. Well, the little a mu just characterizes the translation, which I just erased from the classical legal relation. Now, what about the helicity now? What operator is that connected to? It is essentially characterized as a component of the three component of the angular momentum, J, so which sits kind of buried in these generators here. So let me zoom in on this particular thing. So that's the, in this quantum setting, the component of the angular momentum operator. Along the three momentum, so let me call it K, equal to 0, 0, omega. So now we have just doing things in the, having only non-vanishing things in the three direction. And so the operator relation, of course, yeah, these are now quantum operators, so I should put hats on them. J3, usually these are omitted. So applying this on a vector k, okay, sorry, I'm oscillating here between call them k and p. This is just gives the sigma times the k sigma. So this kind of eigenvalue equation brings out this explicit sigma dependence. And if I now look at the corresponding unitary operator, I have some lambda. And somewhere in these lambdas, in these lambda parameters, is also buried my kind of what was the angle of rotation, you know, around the k vector. That is somewhere in the six parameters that sit are contained in this lambda. This is a kind of collective notation I'm using here. So applying this on this one particle state p sigma gives up to some normalization. Let me not dwell on this. This is just a normalization factor n. A factor e to the I sigma theta. And the theta, as I said, you know, that is just this parameter that, of course, depends here on the lambda entries in some specific way, also on the p's. And what happens here to the one particle state is there's the following. So under the boost, the momentum argument behaves as you would expect it to under the Lorentz, under the rotations and boosts. The sigma is unaffected, but we pick up a phase factor. And the theta, as I said, is this angle we already were working with in the looking at the classical polarized waves. So this is here, kind of the angle about this kind of vector. P, sorry, here I call it P, you know, I should call everything P or K, so this is all the same, apologies. And of course here this is very much the same relation essentially that we also saw for the classical plane wave solutions, polarized ones. So we are retrieving that here in the context of these unitary transformations in the quantum theory. And of course it's no great surprise perhaps, but these constructions, of course, are very similar. So the spin, so this is again helicity, and the magnitude of that is what's called the spin. So what you'll find for the case of gravity is that this can take values, sigma can take values, plus or minus 2. And that's, of course, a characteristic for massless spin 2 field. Okay, now, putting all of these things together, if I now was going to quantize the linear gravitational field, so that is what we looked at classically, these F mu nu's, these kind of linear perturbations. Now, in the quantum theory, this will become a field operator, right? But let me, so, of course, this is what we've seen. The solutions of that are plane waves with certain polarizations that, in a specific gauge choice, were kind of traceless, transverse matrices with these two inherent local degrees of freedom in them. Of course, what one does classically is a quantum field that will be now written as a linear, totally analogously, as a linear combination of field modes which carry these same labels as the classical plane wave solutions. So, and this is, it just looks essentially like a classical like a superposition of the plane wave solutions up to various normalizations. That shouldn't be a sum, that should be an integral. And of course you write it as usual as an integral over Fourier modes, over K modes. So what this looks like is therefore a spatial momentum integral, d3k, normalized in some manner. Well, there are various conventions of how to do this. Now, EK, now the four momenta that appear in the Fourier decomposition, since we are referring to massless particles, they obey K squared equal to zero. So of course, and as usual, as also is true for the massive case, only three of these are independent. Right? This is why this is only a three-dimensional K integral. EK is just basically the modulus of the three momentum. Now, there was a sum, but it's here. Now, the sum is over the helicity states, plus minus 2. And what appears here is now just linear combinations of all the Fourier modes, where I, in addition, keep track of the polarization of the wave. So what I write down is essentially a linear combination with some amplitudes, which I call little a. So they depend on k vector and sigma. Now, this is a unit polarization vector, k sigma e to the I kx plus a, well, a star in the classical theory would be k sigma e star mu nu of k and sigma e to the minus I kx. So if I didn't have the quantum operator here, well, essentially this is just a linear combination of plane waves, which are real. So, you know, I'm adding here two complex conjugate quantities. So these are this E mu nu and the E star mu nu, they are just my unit polarization tensors. So they don't say anything about the magnitude, they just say something about the different directions of polarization, because that is just part of the degree, I mean, the degrees of freedom in these objects. So these are my unit polarization tensors. And in the specific, say, if you work in this specific gauge we are talking about yesterday, they are transverse traceless. So these two things. Now, going to the quantum theory, it's just basically as easy as putting hats about on top of the amplitudes. So, of course, these are classically the amplitudes. That's just tell me the magnitude of that wave. And these things, as usual, as already kind of in the Bose case, they are turned now into annihilation and creation operators, with labels k and sigma. So these are now for the gravitons, if you like. So these are annihilation operators, and these are creation operators, where now the star, of course, becomes a dagger in the quantum theory. These are creation operators of these particular field modes. And they obey canonical, canonical commutation relations. A k sigma with a dagger k prime sigma prime. Now I pick up, I have an additional discrete label, these sigmas, so I pick up an additional Kronecker delta on top of the three-dimensional delta function. Sigma sigma prime and three-dimensional delta function with respect to the three momenta k minus k prime. And of course, by writing them this way, what is always implicit is that an A hat with another A hat gives zero, and an A dagger with another A dagger gives also zero for arbitrary momentum. So these are the only kind of non-trivial commutation relations. So what I want to emphasize again is that clearly what underlies this standard Fock space construction is really the presence of Minkowski space. Because if you didn't have Minkowski space, we also wouldn't have the symmetry, you know, that maps Minkowski space onto itself. So, of course, now, especially in view of that we're talking about gravity with potentially, I mean, curved manifolds, in the case of a curved manifold, there is no global Poincaré symmetry. I mean, there are, it's just no analog of them. I mean, of course, and they can have local structures, they can be locally curved. So the Poincaré group will not be a symmetry. That means if I were to define quantum field theory on such a curved space, well, either I would have to, you know, search for a suitable analog of the Poincaré group, and for very symmetric manifolds, this can be found. But for general manifolds, there is just no such thing. And then I don't even know kind of how to do step one of this construction. So then clearly, the standard Fox space construction will not go through. Here, what enabled us to do this was to say, look, we're starting from a classical situation where my excitations are, can be thought of as weak fields, and therefore this approximation with these linearized fields is a good one. When I do that, I can kind of turn the crank and set up a standard Fox space a quantum theory. Of course, you can already, well, you could already get worried at this stage that, you know, of course, classically, this is not a good approximation for all situations, that also depending on what kind of situations you want to study in the quantum theory, this may have a limited range of applicability too. So that's what I want to end with today. So historically, interestingly, I mean, this way kind of thinking about, you know, quantizing gravity is very, very old. So this goes back to the 30s of last century. Let me just write this down. So the people who did first look at this were Rosenfeld in 1930 and Bornstein in 1936. So you see that goes back a really long time. And what's also kind of as an interesting historical remark, already at that time, people argued what would be a suitable way to quantize this gravitational setup, because of course other things were being looked at. I mean, other, you know, quantum field theories, I mean, electromagnetism, people were starting to understand how this went. And essentially people argued in various ways. First of all, they said, well, this is clearly one way of quantizing it. Then, of course, this raises immediate criticism. Well, already classically, this is a nonlinear theory, so how can this kind of quantization possibly be valid, you know, in a general way? So that would lead us to what we call kind of a non-perturbative quantization of gravity this way. And there were yet other people that said, oh, come on, I mean, gravity is just something that is just applicable macroscopically. And I never have to bother about the quantization. And of course, these three points of view, as I already, you know, mentioned in my first lecture, they're still around in a way. But already, this is like 80 years ago, people were making similar types of arguments. Okay, next time we'll talk a little bit about how real the gravitons are, and then we move on to pass into the quantization. Thank you.